Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, welcome. I'm Dr. Peter Zafiridis, and this is the Healthy Mind Radio Show. Here, we talk about our emotional health and well-being, about living the most authentic life we possibly can, the one we truly deserve. So take notice, our true strength and action are on the march, while our fears and self-doubt are on the run. Never doubt how truly powerful you are. Let's learn together, right here on The Healthy Mind. Oh yes, well, welcome everybody, welcome. I'm your host, Dr. Peter Zafiridis, and this is The Healthy Mind Podcast for October 4th, 2012. Thank you so much for taking time out of your day to listen to the program. I really do appreciate it. And folks, oh, I have a great show planned for you today. For the entire podcast, joining me on The Healthy Mind is Dr. Lewis Aaron, and he is a clinical psychologist and the director of the New York University postdoctoral program in psychotherapy and psychoanalysis. As we've been talking about here on The Healthy Mind over the last few weeks, we have our big conference coming up for the Psychophysiologic Disorders Association in New York City this weekend. And yours truly is actually going to be speaking at it. But I am so looking forward to our third annual conference in New York. We are so blessed to have partnering the event with us this year, New York University and the postdoctoral program in psychology and psychoanalysis. So Dr. Aaron is going to be with us for the whole podcast. He's going to be talking about the state of psychoanalysis today, how it is relevant in our lives day to day, and what we can do to find more meaning in our lives. He's also going to touch a little bit about the role of psychology and therapy as it relates to those individuals that may have psychophysiologic disorders, painful symptoms, discomfort symptoms that come from the emotions. And we've talked about this over and over here on The Healthy Mind. It's actually one of the main themes here at The Healthy Mind. So Dr. Aaron, we are so privileged to have him join us today. He'll be with us for the entire podcast today, so you don't want to miss this particular interview. I really think you're going to take a lot from it. The website, as always, www.thehealthymind.com. Thank you all for visiting it and sharing it with your friends. The traffic on the site has been fantastic. Your emails and comments, I just absolutely love them. Please keep those emails coming. The email address, as always, peter@thehealthymind.com. Okay, well, I am so honored to have Dr. Lewis Aaron join us on The Healthy Mind. Dr. Aaron is an amazing individual, so accomplished, and such a wealth of information. Dr. Aaron is the director of the New York University postdoctoral program in psychotherapy and psychoanalysis. Now, he served as president of the Division of Psychoanalysis of the American Psychological Association, and he's founding president of the International Association for Relational Psychoanalysis and Psychotherapy. He's also founding president of the Division of Psychologists, Psychoanalysts of the New York State Psychological Association. He's received numerous awards. He's received the New York State Psychological Association Distinguished Service Award and the Division of Psychoanalysis Leadership Award. Now, Dr. Aaron holds a diplomat in psychoanalysis from the American Board of Professional Psychology and is a fellow of both the American Psychological Association and the Academy of Psychoanalysis. I could go on for a long time, but I want to tell you this as well. He is the author of multiple books, and really, I urge you to go to his website, www.lewaron.com, that's LEWARON.com, to learn more about Dr. Aaron. But he has written several books, including A Psychotherapy for the People, Towards a Progressive Psychoanalysis, and A Meeting of the Minds, to just mention a couple. It is my honor and pleasure to have Dr. Aaron join us today. So, Dr. Aaron, thank you so much for joining us today on the program.
I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's our pleasure. I guess to get started, I would just ask you if you could let us know a little bit about what kind of led you to this field and what gave you the motivation to move specifically within the area of pain as it relates to emotions.
I'm a psychologist, clinical psychologist, and a psychoanalyst. My academic background was in psychology. Psychoanalysis always was what I wanted to study in that field because it always felt to me, it always represented the deepest level at which you could listen to patients. Psychoanalysis is about listening to people over a long period of time with great intensity, with great interest, and really devoting yourself to understanding what things mean to them, what their psychological world is like, how their psychological world is experienced and structured. I think that of all the different psychologies, psychoanalysis is the field that really studies an individual's subjectivity and the subjectivity, the intersubjectivity between the clinician and the patient. Okay. So it always had great appeal.
That's great. Could you tell us a little bit more about that subjectivity for those who may not be totally familiar with what that means?
Subjectivity meaning really the structure of someone's experience, how they experience the world, and especially how they experience themselves in the world, their own identity, continuity, coherence, and also their experience of the important others, the significant others in their world, so the interpersonal world.
Yes.
And really what psychoanalysis is about is not just studying somebody's conscious and unconscious mind. That doesn't really capture it. It's really about studying that in relation to their experience of the therapist who they're with. How do they experience my mind? How do they experience me thinking about them? How do they experience my feelings about them? And how does that then shape their response to me? So all of that is what we mean by intersubjectivity.
Wow, that's wonderful. And I think for many people listening to this and what they perhaps had as preconceived notions, for whatever reason, of therapy in general and psychoanalysis, this may be very refreshing to some to hear. Because a lot of times when I've talked about these things with my patients, that unconscious, conscious, kind of just those catchphrases, if you will, the id, the ego, the superego seems to dominate, and people almost push away from that. And I'd like to know in terms of from someone who does it, who sees patients regularly in this form of therapy, how have you been able to bridge that gap? I know it's a little bit different in New York City than it might be here in Columbus, Ohio, of course, but I'm sure that you've encountered some of those resistance points as well.
I certainly agree, and I would say it's for good reason. You know, the history of psychoanalysis is a long and rich history, but one troubling aspect of it is that it became very powerful. After World War II, psychoanalysis had great success within psychiatry and within medicine. Psychoanalysis dominated the departments of psychiatry and the departments of psychology were very influenced by it. And with power and prestige and money came arrogance. And psychoanalysis was arrogant for a long time. And I think it did itself a lot of damage, both in terms of its relationship to the public and also in relationship to other professionals who it looked down on and didn't treat with the same esteem. So I think psychoanalysis brought some of its trouble onto itself. And it didn't live up to some of its promises. You know, this post-World War II 1950s period in America was a manic era where American can-do optimism, we were going to cure everything, and psychoanalysis would heal everything. And when it didn't live up to that, I think it got some of its what was coming to it. So I think that we do have to explain psychoanalysis to the public now in a way that they can understand and in a way that does not rely only on the old terms. And to me, very simply, most fields of therapy teach therapists how to intervene, teach therapists techniques. How do you intervene? And of course, that's very important, those activities, those techniques. But most people need to be listened to and understood.
Yes.
And it's not easy to sit and listen to somebody who's in pain. We don't want to do that. We want to pull away. We don't want to listen. What psychoanalysis teaches in a way that I think no other therapy does is how to sit with that difficulty, how to sit with the pain in yourself, listening to pain, how to sit with discomfort, how to sit with conflict and listen to it and really take it in and absorb it. Patients, no matter what techniques you use, they need to be listened to and heard. And that's what psychoanalysis is about.
It really is impressive in hearing you say that. And I think that there's a dichotomy out there. On some level, there's some resistance, but then on other levels, and I'm sure that people will accept it, in that there are very, very true understandings of human behavior that come directly from analysis and understanding, whether it's in the marketing world, whether it is in the business world and what have you, that we do take it in safe bites, but it may be part of the resistance to maybe admit that there's something going on in our lives that needs help beyond just the actual technique per se. I mean, I was really struck by your quote on your website at the homepage, louaron.com. Dr. Aaron said this about psychoanalysis: we listen to their life stories and to the story that they live with us in the room, their past, their present, and future. We listen to what they already know or can see about themselves, and we listen to what they can't see in themselves. And that is real. That is what analysis is doing. And I think, I hope, at least in talking to individuals like yourself, that people can bridge that gap so it doesn't seem intimidating, that it isn't the preconceived notion of what they think it is, because it's a tough enough battle, whether it's in psychology or psychiatry, to have a person walk in the door, period. And then another altogether different battle based on what the media has said or how they have portrayed it. And I really just want to say I really appreciate, in the brief time that I've known you and have read about you, the way that you approach this.
Thank you. I think it's absolutely right. Sometimes the word "the unconscious," that phrase, can turn people off right away. But if you explain to them you're talking about what psychologists today call implicit processes, implicit thought, thought that's in the background, and it can be less intimidating and much more understandable.
Yes, I totally agree. I in developing this, obviously your passion was in psychoanalysis, and in the introduction I described to the audience in terms of just all your accomplishments, in terms of the positions you've held, the multiple books that you have written, the lectures that you've given. Can you tell us a little bit, though, how did all of that initial interest and passion for psychoanalysis then seem to shift a bit towards the physical, the psychogenic and pain? Can you tell us a little bit about that journey for you?
Yeah, I'd be glad to. I'd be glad to. Actually, my first patient, when you go through psychoanalytic training, you see a certain number of patients under very close supervision and you see them for a long time. And it's really the first time that you work with someone multiple times a week and really get into depth with them.
Yes.
And I had an experience that was, I think, very unusual in today's world, which is I had a young man. I was a young man at the time, and he was a young man. And he came in with problems both in his work life and in his romantic relationships. But he was a man who, as a young boy, had had his foot in a cast for a long time because of a problem he had as a young kid. He was immobilized. And something happened to me that I was told was not going to happen, and I probably wouldn't see it in my career, because I was taught that hysterical disorders no longer exist. We don't see hysterical symptoms.
Not there at all.
And this man laid down on the couch. It was the first time I had worked with a patient who was on the couch, and he laid down on the couch, and we saw each other a few times a week. And within the first few weeks of my meeting him, this very strange thing happened. When he would lay down on the couch, his foot became numb and paralyzed. Huh. And he felt that he couldn't move his foot, and it had this numb, tingling sensation. And that happened consistently for the 45 minutes that he would lay on the couch during the analytic sessions. It was a classic hysterical symptom in a man I guess the end of the 20th century.
Yes.
And so, of course, I got very interested in the history of hysteria, the history of hysteria and gender, and how this was a woman's disorder, and here I was seeing it in a man. And we worked together to try and understand this symptom and what it meant to him. And of course, it was a reviving of something that he had experienced as a young boy, which came back to him as a symptom in the analysis. He relived it. He didn't just think about it. He didn't just remember it. But as Freud talked about, people relive their symptoms. They actually embody them in his body. And so, of course, I got very interested in the nature of mind-body connection, the body hysteria. And it brings me, if I can, to the history of psychoanalysis, which I think people may not realize how deeply Freud was involved in the mind-body problem. Really, his whole early effort was to try and understand, at that time they called it hysteria, but what he was really trying to get to was how does the mind influence the body?
Yes.
And he paid tremendous attention to pain and differentiating psychogenic pain or emotionally based pain from pain that was part of physical disease. And this was a great part of his work. And it was very much related to the beginning of studying trauma and how trauma affects the body. Much of this history has been lost over the years, but it's there, and it's there to be mined.
Well, that's fascinating. Now, how much of that continued in his career? Had obviously we know the story and how it sprouted both in Europe and then certainly in America through New York City. But did he maintain that connection to the mind body, or did he shift as his career moved along?
He was always interested in the mind-body relationship. This was throughout his work. He did have different theories, different ways of understanding it at different times. Of course, from the very beginning, he gets interested. Let me put it this way. I think what Freud added to the conversation, because there were people studying hysteria, many before him, he learned from the great masters of his day, Charcot and Bernheim,
yes,
and the doctors in Vienna that he was with and that he studied with. He didn't start it all from scratch. He took what was being worked on and he learned a great deal. But what he added to the conversation at the time was the emphasis on psychological, the patient's individual psychological conflicts, how people were torn apart by different things, how their shame kept them from seeing things, how their guilt kept them from seeing things, and so how they were torn. And so for Freud, these symptoms represented meaning. They represented something that had psychological meaning to the patient, and he saw his job as trying to understand that meaning. This shifted somewhat, but still was very focused on the mind and body when World War I happened, and Freud observed that, of course, so many soldiers were breaking down on the battleground, and Freud, like everybody else in his day, had to come up with explanations of what they called shell shock, or what we would call post-traumatic stress disorder.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, Freud had to revise his theories, because he had been teaching that all of this had to do with sexuality and pleasure. And of course, that wasn't enough of an explanation for why all of these people were breaking down on the battleground. And at that point, he struggled with what he called the repetition compulsion or the death instinct. He tried to come up with ways to understand that went beyond just the theories of sexuality and pleasure. But what he was really saying is, when he talked about the repetition compulsion, what he really meant is that these things no longer were just about personal meaning, because you were repeating trauma that was repetitive. It wasn't just because it had meaning. It was because there was something beyond the pleasure principle, which had to be explained.
An added layer there.
An added layer. And so you see him revising his theories, changing his theories, but all the time it's about the relationship between the mind and the body.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I wonder how much of that pays tribute to the fact that he was a neurologist at first and continued to be. But I wonder how much of that, because he was trained as a physician, just by nature, was going to be considered in a mind-body perspective.
Yeah, of course he did, like many people of his day. He did, you know, he was an adherent of Cartesian dualism. He did believe in this separateness of the mind and the body. but he knew that they interacted. It wasn't the same kind of holistic vision that we might have today.
Yes.
And so things have certainly changed, and with the impact in recent years of the neurosciences, I think that psychoanalysis, like all fields, has to keep changing and updating. It's not our grandfather's psychoanalysis.
No, that's absolutely true. And I think that that's such an important message for people to hear, that it isn't a stodgy old therapy. It is also changing as our understanding changes of all of this. And I've talked about that many times on the program. We have to be careful not to get stuck in dogma. If there is evidence of even some of our theories that have been refuted, we have to at least consider them. And we respect all the points of view, and we change as we absolutely need to. I wanted to go back, though, because something struck me that you were saying about the pain experience and the hysteria, particularly with your patient that you had seen the first time, that he relived that experience. It wasn't just a memory of it. And I know that there's a lot of individuals who will listen to the podcast that have listened or read the work of Dr. Sarno, tension myositis syndrome, have been to the PPDA and such. But can you tell us a little bit about that, reliving that, and maybe how that applies to the more modern day association with pain and mood?
As you very well know, pain is probably the main thing that brings people into doctors. It's the main complaint. It's the main symptom, and whether we're talking about actually physical pain, psychological pain, emotional pain, this is really what we deal with, and we have to learn to listen to. But what the point of that I was making is that a lot of people, I think of psychoanalysis as intellectualized, and it's, yes, about thinking and talking and what's in your head. But of course, the essential thing is reliving, re-experiencing. Psychoanalysis and any good psychotherapy is as much about the experience as it is about thinking about the experience. We, of course, we think and we reflect. Reflection is very important, but it's the actual experience, the perception that matters, and where change can happen is in the body, in the perceptual experience. Very central to any kind of therapeutic change.
What do you believe is the reason for that? What is it about that therapeutic moment, the re-experiencing in a way of not just recalling it? How do you feel that happens? Because that's a very common question that comes up either in my patients or in emails and the like, in terms of, why does this happen? Why is it that I can read a book or listen to a lecture and all of a sudden my pain gets better? What exactly is happening there?
I think that the message is that thinking is critical, reflection is critical, and of course thinking and reflection themselves are experiences. It's not as if there's a binary where they're not experiences, but life has to be lived. And people live it with other people. They live it together in relationships. And where change happens is in the experience, in the body, and in the experience and in the body's meeting. What I call my first book, A Meeting of Minds, but really a meeting of minds and bodies. Change has to be real. It has to be in lived experience.
And do you feel that the fact that that can be experienced again, but in the safety of that environment, the therapeutic environment, that it changes the dynamic of how it's understood? Is that fair, or am I speculating there?
No, I think that's very much the way this is thought about. Mm-hmm. Safety is one of the core needs that people have. And if they don't feel safe, there's really not much else you're going to be able to do with them.
That's right.
They need to feel safe. They need to feel that they have agency, that they have a voice, that they have say. But certainly the first thing that you want to do with any patient is establish the kind of therapeutic alliance, the kind of relationship where there's an atmosphere of safety.
Yes.
That includes, of course, the safety to experience pain and feel that it's going to be under control and not get out of control.
Yes. And, you know, in talking with you, my specific area of orientation is existential in nature, and we've talked about that before here on the program. But the basic tenets, really, in hearing you talk, I can understand where this is not a division. It is simply just a bit of a difference, perhaps in some themes, but the structure and the reason that people heal is exactly the same. I mean, what you're saying about psychoanalysis is exactly how I explain the healing that occurs in existential therapy that is done.
Peter, I completely agree. It's not a binary. The psychoanalysis has been affected over the years, over the decades, has absorbed a tremendous amount from other disciplines, from the culture. It has continued to change. Of course, Freud was writing pre-existentialism. There's no doubt about it, although Binswanger was one of his students, was one of the leading figures in existential psychoanalysis and also in psychosomatics and in pain management. But, you know, the era of the humanistic therapies, the 1960s, the development of family therapy, the development of other humanistic therapies have all been absorbed by contemporary psychoanalysts. We all study each other's work. And I think to think of any of these as isolated and not in touch with the others really doesn't make any historical sense.
Yeah, and I couldn't agree more. I know we have the conference that is coming up in New York this weekend, and with the PPDA and NYU, the postdoctoral program in psychoanalysis, and that is the whole goal, fortunately, of all of us within the board of the PPDA. This is not my therapy is better than yours, but that these are all fundamentally the same in principle of how they heal. And perhaps the benefit of hearing all these different viewpoints is we find a person who may respond better to a different form of therapy than the other, but that we have the choice to be able to help our patients in the best possible way. I don't see it as competing in any way.
I'm very excited about the conference on Saturday for several reasons, including the one you're discussing, and I'll start with that.
Please.
One reason I'm so excited about this is I do think that interdisciplinary discussion is exactly what we need. Among different kinds of therapists, among different kinds of scientists, among the humanities, interdisciplinary studies is going to be where the action takes place. I think that each kind of therapist that comes is going to have something to contribute, something unique. I think psychoanalysis, what it has that's unique, is this intensity and depth of its exposure to listening to patients over long periods of time. That gives us something unique to say about the individual's subjectivity. But therapy is going to bring something that it's going to offer to this conversation, and we need to be in the room together talking. But I want to add to that this conference also is going to include consumer advocates and consumers, patients. And I think that one of the things that psychoanalysis has not taken enough advantage of is getting feedback from our patients, from former patients, really getting input about the nature of their experience. And so I think a dialogue that includes not only other therapists, but patients, consumers, consumer advocates, the public, that kind of conversation is overdue. And I think it's very exciting that we're going to have that together.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. I think that in the state of I'll speak for medicine, but certainly in therapy as well. It almost seems that the patient almost is the adversary, and the health and the direction and the healing only comes when the individual is engaged in their healing. So for the same reasons, I think that it is an absolute critical portion that not only the for lack of a better word, experts are in the audience and listening, but that the consumers themselves meaningfully contribute to what they need, and we hear them and then modify our approach based on their needs. I'll speak for medicine only. There's not enough of that in medicine today. And probably part of the reason why we see medicine not working as well as we think. Medicine in general, not necessarily pharmaceuticals, but the practice of medicine in general.
You know, there's a recent article in the Journal of the American Psychoanalytic Association by Robert Emdy, who's a leading developmentalist, but it's all about the role of psychoanalysis in healthcare system as it's evolving and changing. And he makes the point very much along these lines, too, that, you know, either we're going to be a part of it or we're going to be shut out and isolated. Mm-hmm. And what medicine is facing in upcoming changes in medicine is going to be focusing on the individual's needs the individual's experience. It's a more humanistic approach to medicine. And if medicine is going to thrive, that's really where it has to turn its attention. All of the research indicates that it's the individualization of medicine that it's gonna that will make it in the long run more cost effective and more effective.
Yeah, and I couldn't agree. I think some of the, let us say, the problems or the hiccups that psychoanalysis suffered over the years is pretty similar, I think, in principle to what medicine has, in the sense that there was such an explosion of knowledge in the physiologic and in the biologic that somewhere along the way it left the fact that there's a human being here. And yes, there are very important physiologic and biological issues that are happening, but we also have to understand where that person lives with all of this, because the healing doesn't simply come from just a pill or a particular procedure, if you will. So it's nothing that I believe is unique to analysis or therapy in general. I think it's all of us have felt that from just the explosion of knowledge.
The technological explosion, the technological evolution and revolutions always have to be balanced by the focus on the relationship.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, we all know that. All of us feel it. My patients feel it. It's not an accident that we see all of these extended levels of care or alternative levels of care, whether it is therapy or other types of complementary and alternative medicine practitioners and disciplines joining. Because it's not just as simple as the rote allopathic model. It simply isn't. But I think the population has been telling us that for years. But I think it's finally where we're starting to see a significant turn. And that's why I'm so excited about, specifically for us in the PPDA, that this is, I think, a very unique moment to be able to advocate and say, look, we're not trying to explain everything, but you must include psychology in the pain experience, or else you are going to continue to be frustrated with the outcomes that you have for your patients, or the patients themselves are going to be continuing to feel frustration that they're not feeling better. Well, I am so excited to get to this conference. I can't tell you how much, and I'll be sharing with the listeners next week about the outcome. Dr. Aaron, I hope that you will come on again if you'd be interested. I'd love to have you on for almost a post-conference analysis to maybe wrap up what we talked about today and maybe share with the audience what we felt were the most salient points that we got across.
Peter, thank you. I really enjoy talking to you, and I'm looking forward to meeting you in person on Saturday. Yes. I'll be very glad to come back and do another show with you whenever you want. Before we end up, I do want to just mention that the New York University postdoctoral program in psychotherapy and psychoanalysis is really delighted to be doing this with the PPDA. Your audience may not know, we're a very specialized training program. We train people that already have PhDs, doctoral degrees in psychology, and who are going on to do advanced training in psychotherapy and psychoanalysis. It's a program that takes many, many years. These are all experienced, licensed mental health people. And I would say that in terms of our conversation today, these are all people who read about all the therapies, study about all the therapies. Most of them are experienced in other kinds of therapy, CBT, family therapy, couples therapy, child therapy, group therapy, and are coming for many years to do advanced training in psychoanalysis. They're interested in the changes in contemporary medicine and contemporary psychology. And so for us, this is a wonderful opportunity to join in with you and share this in the interdisciplinary conference.
Oh, we are absolutely honored. It's a privilege for us to be affiliated with NYU on this conference. And I wanted to specifically ask you about the program. You mentioned how long is that particular postdoctoral program? I mean, I imagine there's a variety of times, but what has been your experience with those that come and get further training?
Most people are doing this program on a part-time basis because they're working. They have practices or they work in a hospital or a clinic. They already have their PhD. They're already licensed. And they stay in our program on average about 10 to 13 years.
Okay.
So this is like a long continuing education where they and they put in a good amount of time and they see patients and they go through their own analysis. And of course, they take many courses and and it's a long, over 10-year period to become a psychoanalyst.
Wow, that's incredible. Wow, it's been such a pleasure to talk to you. I feel like I could go on for another hour or two and still not get enough out of this. But if people want to learn more about you, about the program, what's the best way for them to get in contact with you?
Very easily. You already gave my website, which is www.louaron.com. And I have links from my webpage right on the homepage. There are links to NYU's program. There are links to the various journals and other associations that we're involved with.
Wow, thank you. That's wonderful to know. If you have a chance, ladies and gentlemen, please visit Dr. Aaron's site. We are going to do everything we can here at The Healthy Mind, because this has been one of the missions, is to change the face of therapy and what it means and what it doesn't. And specifically with Dr. Aaron, I'm going to do my best to kind of shake the trees and rethink what people feel psychoanalysis is and what it isn't. And again, I can't thank you enough today for joining us on the program, and I look forward to having you join me again in the future.
I'll meet you Saturday.
All right, wonderful. Thank you. And there he goes, ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Louis Aaron, the director of New York University postdoctoral program in psychotherapy and psychoanalysis. My goodness. Wow. What a brilliant, brilliant mind. What an honor it is for me to have Dr. Aaron on the program. I cannot thank him enough for joining us. This is just a wonderful, wonderful teaser for me as we approach this week's conference in New York City. I truly hope that you learned as much as I did during the course of this broadcast. That does it for us this week on The Healthy Mind. Thank you so much, ladies and gentlemen, for taking the time out of your day to listen to the program. I truly do appreciate it. The website, as always, www.thehealthymind.com. Don't forget to sign up for your absolutely free monthly newsletter and email alerts on the homepage. You can follow me on Twitter as well. I'm at Dr. Zafiridis. And any questions, comments, criticisms, anything, I want to hear from you. Send me your email and send it along to peter@thehealthymind.com. That's peter@thehealthymind.com. And for the Healthy Mind Podcast, part of the Healthy Mind Network, I'm Dr. Peter Zafiridis. Have a great week, everybody, and I'll see you next time right here on The Healthy Mind.